Derowick, a class discussion in three parts. Part three, 34 minutes.
See, it is a subgrouping of the collective, but it's interesting because
it's a peer group, though.
It's a peer group, but notice that it's guided, the peer group is guided by one figure in particular.
Yeah, the little sister.
The little sister. So the peer group, there is a you could think of it as a collective of the feminine, but there is an individual within that collective who seems to have a greater wisdom, right? And then there's the multiplying of the feminine ego strength.
She's a little killer. Yes.
Well, she's a lot of things.
You don't piss her off.
She's a very interesting
out of spear, baby.
I'm just so devastated by 14. You know, he wasn't going to do anything.
He got permission.
He wasn't going to do anything. I mean, this poor guy, and look what happened.
Pretending he was young with all his prejudices, he got what he deserved.
He was such a good guy. He was just a normal guy. He gets up in the middle of the night, you know, but suddenly, you know, he realizes this is, no, he's told this is not the right thing. Goes back to sleep. That's it.
That's
how it happens.
Male figure.
This is just awful.
What about that? I forgot to ask the question. What about the rafters and the grass and the lizards who cry out and say, "No, you imbecile! What do you think you're doing? What does that represent?"
What measures the consciousness?
Well, it's not exactly consciousness. I mean, it's rafters don't have consciousness. It's not human consciousness. What is it?
Yeah, universal forces.
Universal forces. What are we saying here? It's very interesting. Very profound philosophical points being made.
There are rules. There are universal rules.
Natural law.
Yeah, but what are these natural laws? What are these natural laws about? It's not instinct, is it? Because instinct, if instinct alone was allowed to function, Ting would probably rape his sister. That's, sex is an instinct, and brothers have a sexual instinct. If you give them a chance, they're liable to molest their little sisters.
Well, one thing is that life is sacred and it should be permitted to, you know, flower in its own space.
Life is sacred. It's such a profound thing that you're saying. Life is sacred to whom?
To the person who has it. Or to the collective.
Yeah, to the collective.
We'll all benefit if we all.
But see, the point is, this story is so interesting. The collective apparently doesn't know what to say. They don't think it's sacred. They say, fine, you can marry your sister.
No, they all deferred.
Yeah.
They have nothing to say.
They all said, ask somebody else.
The collective doesn't realize the sacredness, but the rafters.
Guilty by silence, yeah.
The rafters realize the sacredness. Mm. So what are we talking about?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting point. That you talk about wilderness, and you know, it has, like, William Blake's great. He talks about heaven and hell. You know, there's this universal wilderness, great force, but it can be very devastating, killer. You know, man eat man. You know, it's like Aries out of control. You know. So you need something like a Saturn kind of thing. You need some cultivation of nature in order for productivity to occur.
But that's more like moral values.
Moral values. But you see, it's the rafters, it's the lizards, it's the thatch which cries out. So you see, this is profound. The image, the legend is saying that there is, and there's other evidence for it too, repeated evidence, that there is within the unconscious, there is the potential for individuation. Now, the unconscious is not just wilderness, it's not just nature, tooth and claw. The unconscious also contains within it the idea that psychological potential is sacred and should be protected.
Mm.
It's a very, very interesting idea that individuation is not just the invention of consciousness. Because really, consciousness doesn't invent things. Consciousness receives potentials from the unconscious. You know, if you look at, if you think about the Odyssey, you think about the way that mysterious story unfolds, that Odysseus goes through this long individuation journey, sailing from island to island, having all these experiences. All those adventures that he have are mediated and arranged by the gods. So the gods represent non-human potentials that can unfold, that human beings can find their way through. The gods will provide guidance if a human being is willing to find his way. And so here, because Dirawik is willing to search and journey, nature, the unconscious, will provide guidance.
God even provides food for her here.
Yeah, exactly. That was another repetition, that the gods provided the food in the anthills. That the unconscious, even though it is unconscious, nevertheless has an interest and provision for individuation. Very, very interesting idea.
Very interesting.
And it's all in this African myth. It's all here. It's just extraordinary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's something Bar Aesop's Fables, which is a copy of here. It's a reminder of
it. Okay. It's interesting in the. I study this in Indian philosophy, and there's something called Bhuti, which is like a discriminating intelligence. You're faced with these universal forces, and it seems like the little girl, the little sister, is a discriminating intelligence because there's something that you need to kind of navigate through this. Because like you said, there this ancient archival intelligence, whatever it is, there are good things, there are the lizards, but also there's natural inclinations to rape your sister. So within this unconscious realm, there's demons, angels, and kind of like a real mixed lot. So,
and as you say, the potential for discrimination is also...
Yeah, so the little sister seems to be that discriminating intelligence that allows her to find the way.
Okay, interesting point.
It's kind of like Buddha's philosophy also, or like the latter part, Mahayana, I think,
mm-hmm.
where you have the human being with the 10 worlds being the potentials of, say, the range of emotions, mm-hmm. from hell, hunger, animality, rapture, tranquility, and then Buddhahood is where you're able to integrate everything so that as a Buddha, if you become angry, it's going to create some kind of value. It's not just that you're angry, just going off. Anyway, that's who said that.
So. It's interesting, the Eastern traditions has it.
But let's come back to the images in the story. There's another image very early on in the story, which, again, repeats the idea that there are natural forces which are providing for the unfolding of this story.
Mm-hmm.
There's another image. It's a different kind of image which repeats this idea. What is it? Right in the early part of the story. Even before the rafters and the lizards speak.
Is this when he kills the ox,
yeah.
and then it's taken up and thrown down on
yes.
Derek's lap?
So what's that? So what does that suggest?
It's a supernatural kind of
It's a supernatural
force.
The bird, right, is a supernatural force, yes. And what do you think? If you think about the image of the oxtail, which the kite picks up and drops, kind of in Derwick's lap, what might that be an image of? What's that like? When do we have an ox's tail dropped in our lap? Think of an ox's tail. These images are specific. Think about an ox's tail. Let's stay with the image. What is an ox's tail like? Think about it.
It's a long time since I've seen an ox. I assume it's tough and muscular.
Stubborn.
Long. Rigid.
Relative to the ox, big or small?
Small.
Small relative to the ox. Complete or fragmented?
Fragmented.
Fragment. Muscular. It wriggles. It's small. It's a fragment. Where does it come from?
The rear part.
OK. Okay, and it comes from the rear. Which is to say...
It's part of it.
Huh?
It's part of the spine. Or the...
Yeah, but symbolically, the rear... The unconscious, perhaps, comes from the back of the ox, the least conscious part of the ox. And in the story, where does it come from?
His favorite.
For Derek, where does Derek experience it as coming from?
From the sky.
From the sky, from the heavens. So it's dropped into her awareness from the heavens.
Yeah.
From the spiritual world, it's dropped into her heavens. And what does it function as?
Premonition. Information.
Information, a sign, right? It provides
that's
a little
like a
bit
symbolism.
Of,
yeah.
Provides a little bit. Of, so what is that?
An omen.
What is a fragment of information which is dropped from the heaven into our awareness and provides us with a sign as to what's going on? It comes from the unconscious. It is dropped into our awareness.
Synchronicity.
Like dream.
Synchronicity.
A dream.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yes, synchronicity could be it too. But it's what it's most like is a dream.
Well, she gets it while she's in the water fishing. So you could say that, you know, in the unconscious. So she's conscious, willfully fishing in the water.
That's true. But if you just stay with the ox's tail, a dream is a little... piece of a little story.
A little fragment.
A little fragment.
Fragment of the ox.
From the unconscious, which is dropped into our awareness and to give us crucial information when we need it.
Right.
So look at that. Look at that. Look how specific and subtle it is.
And she was upset because she thought she tied the ox off.
There's another story that I analyze, which I think the woman who became a spider. In that story, there's the image of lemmings which are dropped from heaven. And they function as dreams. So the ox's tail, which is dropped from heaven, in this axis story is a little bit like a lemon. It's a little thing which has its own muscles and can tell you something.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Well, no, I mean, I think the whole concept of animation of things that we don't think of as speaking. I know the first time I did a sweat lodge, the woman had said, gather water, rocks, wood, and when you bring the rock, ask it if it wants to be in the sweat lodge. I'm like, ask a rock. What do you want me to do? She asked the rock if it wants to be in the sweat lodge. I'm like, okay, like just talk to it. She goes, yeah. I'm like, so I pick up a rock and you want to be in the sweat lodge? And I did about five rocks. About the sixth rock, it went no. And I have to say, I'd never talked to a rock before. And I was like, it said no. Do you want to be in the sweat lodge? No. Okay, put it down. And then after the sweat lodge, the rocks all completely convert from the heat and the water and the emotion and all that happens. They were all completely transformed. So that rock was happy doing rock stuff. He didn't want to go through the transformation. But we don't often think of the things around us as being animated or being part of the cosmic intelligence. They are. On some level, we don't know how it all works. Jung called it synchronicity, but it's, you know, oxtail. What does that mean? I thought I left him tied. And it's a cosmic clue on love for her to go on her own journey. Not be tied.
Lest
she be slaughtered.
You want to say something?
No, I was just thinking, well, you think you know what reality is and then things can shift around. Surprise.
Mm-hmm. Well, I never talked to a rock before. You know, I never said, do you want to be in this? And, you know, and it was kind of like, wow.
So you're moving into another realm of reality. The symbolic realm, yeah.
Symbolic realm.
So the lion, we don't have much time left, but I just want to say a couple of things. What do you think the lion represents here?
Her life force.
Well, okay, it's life force, but...
Masculine life force.
Masculine life force, but let's be more specific.
Untamed masculine
life force. Untamed, yeah. A lion has... There's a very...
Dangerous.
Dangerous. Why is a lion dangerous?
It can eat you.
It can eat you with what?
Claws.
Well, it doesn't eat with the claws.
Ferociousness.
But if you look at a lion, it has huge jaws.
Doesn't.
Massive jaws.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about appetites. Devouring appetite.
Right.
Which in a lion is... A lion, the devouring potential is enormous because that's massive... devouring. And a lot of attention, the girls pay a lot of attention to the lion's mouth, the beating and so on, and the scalding with hot breath. They neutralize the massive devouring potential of the lion's mouth. So we're talking about the appetites, and this is a repetition. We've already seen that Ting's appetite was a threat. His lust could have derailed Dirawak's development.
Mm-hmm.
And so here's the lion. The lion is the issue, the lust, the issue of appetite alone, mm-hmm. which has to be relativized. Okay.
Yeah, I just want to say one thing. It's in the tarot cards, a strength card. I'm not sure if you guys are familiar, but it's a big lion, and this angel, it tames him. It seems like that's kind of the theme of this whole story,
mm-hmm.
the integration of energy, and the card is kind of poignant.
Okay. Now, another question. What about the basket made of reeds?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask about.
Think about a basket made of reeds as the vessel for carrying water. What are we doing here? What's going on?
I thought the little girl was tricking the lion.
It's a trick, yes. It is a trick. And, of course, it works very well. But what kind of a trick?
It's like the lion's not, is this, it's not an intelligent energy.
Okay, the lion is fool. Yeah, that's right.
It's not discriminating.
The devouring lust is not as smart as the sister.
Right.
But what is the nature of the trick that the sister plays upon the lion? Stay with the image. What is it that the sister uses to fool the lion? A basket, right? She uses a basket.
Perceptive.
Mm-hmm.
And what is a basket?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of thing is a basket?
Well, generally it's something women weave.
Yes, it's something. So look what she's doing. She's using a feminine vessel
mm-hmm.
to trick the lion.
Mm-hmm.
So we're dealing with this dangerous devouring lust, which could destroy the feminine. But the feminine skill which is used to neutralize the lust. It's a woven basket, which of course lets the water out.
Mm-hmm.
So the feminine is being used to neutralize this devouring energy.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's...
The reeds can't hold it. Well, that's that same thing we had last week with the story with Pablo and the honor word.
Mm-hmm.
This is the same kind of tricking, because he went down and tried to fill the water and it washed away.
Uh-huh.
Kept trying till dawn.
Yeah. Now let's talk about Dirawak's sister, because mm-hmm. we've been talking about her. But she's a very interesting figure.
I think of her as the inner voice.
The inner voice, okay.
You know, the little wise part that goes, you know, I didn't do that.
So she always seems to know,
she
right?
knows, yeah.
She always knows.
Inner knowing.
And what happens to her?
She gets thin.
She gets thin, and what else happens?
She becomes responsible for protecting the group.
Yes.
And it's a sacrifice.
The sacrifice, mm-hmm. right? So, and as the story proceeds, what happens to her?
She almost gets killed.
Okay, she almost gets killed, yes. And then what happens?
She gets rebuked by the group.
She cries, she tells the truth,
mm-hmm.
she gets rebuked. What is she doing at night? What happens night after night?
Yeah,
what
she's like the unconscious because she's awake during the nights. And she's asleep during the day.
She's repeatedly visited by the lion, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she repeatedly refuses the lion, right? Again and again. And defies the lion's offers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens to her? Do you hear about it?
Well, she gets thin, and
she
then
gets thin,
very bony. I don't know what happened to her.
Well, do you hear from her?
No, she kind of goes away.
She actually disappears,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, when they go back to the village, she disappears.
She's gone. So you said
well, she's an integration of the inner voice.
Well, Barbara, you said it's a kind of a sacrifice, right?
So she gets killed, or she disappears?
She disappears. So she has...
She left in the wilderness?
Well, we're not told that, but she's apparently lost in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, the girls who come back have a lot of wisdom, right? When they come back wise, and they seem to have somehow integrated her wisdom.
Integrator.
So look at this figure. This is a figure who night after night is approached by this dangerous, potentially destructive force, mm-hmm. and who withstands it, who refuses its offers again and again, and then is sacrificed and transformed halfway through the story. Does that remind you of anything? Does that remind you of a Western myth?
Transformed halfway through the story.
Who, a figure of great wisdom who is vulnerable. The figure of great wisdom who is vulnerable, who doesn't just prevail, but in fact sacrifices herself.
Well, Obi-Wan Kenobi, but he's a boy.
And there's a bigger story than that you know about.
Well, the one I love, I'm not sure you're talking about, is Prometheus.
Well, let's stay with the dominant culture in our present world. And let's...
Mary, who sacrifices herself? I don't know.
No, you're getting closer. What's the very well-known myth that this... resembles?
Jesus.
See, it's so unfamiliar. You're not used to thinking of her as the little sister in Africa, but it's the story of Jesus.
Hmm.
You know, the source of great wisdom who is sacrificed in order to, and transformed in order to allow humankind to move to a higher level of development. So this is very, very interesting. We have the whole myth of Christ prefigured in this African story as a feminine figure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you said the lion is like the devil, speaking over your shoulder. You said that before. So, you know, and Jesus goes up on the mountain and he's tempted by the devil three times,
mm-hmm.
you know. The devil comes to him and offers him, you know, just give your allegiance to me and I will give you this whole kingdom. And Christ says, no, I'm not going to do that. The devil comes back again. Christ says, no, I'm not going to do that. The devil says, you know, I will spare you this sacrifice. You do not have to suffer. And the devil says, no, I'm not going to do that. I accept the sacrifice. And then Christ allows himself to be seized and crucified, as does the little sister. She suffers, she goes through the suffering, and she's lost. She disappears.
Mm-hmm.
So
what's that relevance to our, you know, internal individuation?
Well, the story of Christ is an individuation story. It's the story of the sacrifice of the strong, dominant. Christ refuses to be a king in the old collective sense. He refuses to accept the crown that the people want to give him. He insists that he represents a higher value than that, and he's not going to be crowned as a king. And he allows himself to be totally transformed by crucifixion in order to allow this individuation potential, the individuation process, to be redeemed. You know, to go through the individuation process is to sacrifice the power and the dominance which the ego has gained in order to achieve a higher level of wisdom.
So that's part of the integration, really, ultimately.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. But how amazing is this, that this whole dominant Christian myth,
mm-hmm.
is prefigured in,
mm-hmm.
this pagan...
Right. Well,
but there's
a lot of Christian
stuff
that's been
pointed out.
From different cultures.
Like,
yeah. Well, it's universal truth.
Right.
I thought there was a relationship with the Joseph myth also. Of the, of course, Joseph gets thrown into the hole in the ground. He emerges eventually triumphant also. And the people bow down to him and worship him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it must have been a theme. And another one of these archetypical themes of the endangered individual who eventually triumphs.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that's very interesting and nice about this is that it's in the feminine. So it shows Christ, the feminine dimension of the story, which is very interesting for us.
Well, Christ's whole relationship to his mother is pretty interesting.
Well, I think that when we're looking at it, a lot of times when you are on your own journey, there'll be people that come as part of the path, and then there comes a time when you leave them or they leave you or whatever, and there's a sacrifice on some level involved. Leaving home, moving off, and as part of your own being able to follow your own wisdom path. Or so very often the person who was part of that process gets left or is, you know, their work is finished on some level.
Also, like, in development terms, I mean, is that also at the, you know, since this is about a sort of maturation, individuation, understand how you've presented it, is it also sort of, I guess I'm restating what you've already said, but that, you know, the women have developed, and so the sacrifice is made, and it's almost that phase of development is over. And this is the higher truth or the higher about the collective as well, since it's they all come back stronger.
And re-inform the collective.
As you may notice, the discussion went a little bit off track here. I kind of went off target a little bit because the image is really, the Christ image is about a God who is sacrificed on earth, God's Son who is crucified and grounded into the earth. What was purely archetypal and celestial, which is to say pure potential, and that implies limitless potential, something that has no substance, no material substance, and therefore is without any limits, is transformed into something that is essentially limited and bound by mortality and normal human limitations. That's the sacrifice of the limitless state to come into a bounded incarnated state, incarnated bodily form which can suffer and die. And the same, and the Durwick's little sister seems to fit that image. So it's not the sacrifice of the old dominant ego position in order to make room for a new ego position. It's rather the sacrifice of the archetypal potential, which amounts to an incarnation of it into earthly form. And it seems like Durek's sister is sacrificed, and her wisdom is incarnated in the wisdom of the girls as they tame the lion and come back into civilization. So, just adding a corrective here.
Could you possibly give a very basic example of that in terms of psychology?
A therapist and a patient parting.
So could you explain that?
Well, a therapist saying, you know, or the patient saying, okay, I think I'm done, or whatever. You know, the separation process, because you've done intense work,
mm-hmm.
and then you're like, okay, I got to go now. Time, you know, or you feel like you finished what you were there to work on. So the separation process, therapist very often has to hold that container, let you go,
mm-hmm.
not cry, kind of go, you're good, go, have, you know, be well.
But what's the prior dominant that you're letting go?
Because you come in to work with them as a reflection, and they have to hold, they, you know, ostensibly they have more knowledge than you, which is why you're in there. They've done their work, so they do some kind of transferring of teaching and wisdom
mm-hmm.
and reflect to you, so you figure it out, so you move to wholeness or move to whatever. So then you have to figure out, how do I leave? So do I leave as an equal? Do I have to kill the therapist off? Do I, you know, do bad thing? Do I start playing money game? What do I do to leave?
But
if you have a
prior
mentor,
to
then it's time to fly on your own, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
But prior to that sacrifice, this theme of repetition is real important. There's a lot of literature about ritual and placebo, and the healing power of ritual if you take it to heart. And the necessity of repeated affirmation, which is, you know, in Buddhist and in the Indian traditions, this whole idea, or in church, of hearing the same sage message, not just one time, because then it's just intellectual, whatever, but the repetition, the information in such a way that it saturates the being. And only after that can... And in modern science, in psychiatric work, there's ritual has a profound placebo effect. Or get married.
To get wise. Well, maybe you have to get married and you have to deal with the opposite sex and relationship.
Yeah, my intellectual arguments don't work in my life.
Yeah, so you have to be humble.
It's like, you know, it's...
Yeah.
If I just follow that a little bit... But in terms of the unconscious, there's always something else. What's that?
It's a frigging onion. You get it?
No, I know, but I mean, in terms of even the repetition within the story, in terms of growth, this kind of growth, individuation enables, right? It keeps happening.
Repeated sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
So then you're able to do more and more.
So we're almost finished.
Yeah, we are.
I just want to get back to this point I was making at first, that here we have probably thousands and thousands of years before there was a Greece, before there was a Rome, before there were Jews, before there was anything we know. And here we have, in African culture, these deep understandings of the human experience being related generation to generation. You know, it's just so impressive.
And without the use of Google.
What's that? No, it's just
What's that all about?
It's awesome.
You don't
awesome.
Need internet for that.
There was a movie a few years back, The Gods Must Be Crazy, also that came out of Nigeria. You remember that?
Excellent.
It was in the movie, in the theaters like 2 or 3 years ago. The deep knowledge of experience in the African community.
Because I make the argument on my website in my article on painting, Cézanne and Winnicott mm-hmm. and Jung, I make the argument that if you look at sculpture, the ancient Paleolithic sculptures which have been found, some of which are 30 or 20,000 years old, they show evidence of the individuation process. So that in, you know, the oldest artifacts that we have, or some of the oldest artifacts that we have access to, they show evidence of individuation. Mm-hmm. So you might want to take a look at that.
Yeah, I mean, we're born with two sides of the brain inherent in the structure of a human being. There must have been some collective sort of things that followed it. You know, themes were created, DNA. Right?
I don't know. I sort of think. I hate, this is not politically correct, but perhaps as a white person, if you have a tendency to think in a certain way, maybe more technological or whatever, so you're developing yourself in a certain way, and maybe with Africans, you're more spiritual because that's what you have to work with.
Let her finish.
Barbara
Steele.
Sorry.
Yes.
I also think the human being is changed according to his environment. So the African man in Africa may be a white person that's been transformed by the heat of the sun over thousands of years, etc. And so then that makes you not use your brain in a certain way. I mean, there's so many factors.
Three words. I'll just say three words.
Yeah.
We're all African.
We're all African.
No,
at this point.
No, I accept your point. There are different cultural mores and different values. It's very interesting conversation by itself.
Yeah. Okay, guys. Thank you so much. Lovely discussion.
This is the end of part 3. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this class, and I hope you will listen to the other classes which are also available on this website.